Blazek.
Here.
Brady. Brownstein. Christensen.
Ready to go.
German.
Here.
Laut.
Here.
Snell.
Here. Okay. So we do have a quorum now. Agenda item number 2, call to the public. Christina, still no one signed in?
No one signed in.
All right. Then we'll move to agenda item number 3, notice of proposed rulemaking, and open it up to the committee members for discussion. I think last we left off, different members were going to reach out to some of their lobbyists and see what we could do about working together with some type of interagency agreement. Does anybody have an update on that?
Yeah, I'll be happy to give you an update. So this is Blazek. Our lobbyist, Stuart Goodman, met with the CRNA lobbyist. I think her first name is Jesse. And they had some very good discussions. I do believe there was some discussions with Ryan, as well as the new executive director for the Arizona Dental Association. And this is maybe 10 days ago, they were going to put together a stakeholder meeting.
Great.
So that's where we're at. Seemed positive on all sides, I thought, is what I was led to believe by Stuart.
Are we including the MD lobbyists in group, or are we not really?
We did not.
Okay. And probably no need to, since this is more of a CRNA.
Well, I think that some information may be garnered from the stakeholder meeting that may move us in that direction, or that the, but you know, I think we're just going to find out some more information.
Okay.
You know, maybe truly how the board feels about it, how the dental association feels about it, and then move from there.
Okay. Good. That's great. Thank you for working on that.
Mm-hmm.
There's been more edits and suggestions, it looks like, on the rules. Any updates with that?
This is Snell. I just went through and made the edits that I was asked to. Well, made some of the edits I was asked to for some of the definitions, and then went through some of the previous edits that I had done, like that talk when we were way back when talking about level 1 and 2, and I took some of those out. So to try to help the committee, I kind of did a little key there where the blue stuff that were ones that I had just recently done. And then some green stuff. There were some, like I know Ollie did some ton of work that I didn't touch for like a new permit and changed up to 1304 because of that. And so then it made some of the R4-1301 too. All that was kind of messed up. So I didn't go back and edit those and change those. So there's still stuff that I saw in here that probably needs to be cleaned up, but I didn't get that far because I didn't want to touch Ollie's stuff since that was his part that did it. So
appreciate you going through that.
This is German. So as far as the pediatric edits go, all I did was incorporate the pediatric edits that we had talked about or discussed in this committee and approved as far as age and some of the case number requirements and some of the staffing situations that we discussed. So I incorporated those. I think I had already done this, but if I didn't, then we need to redact my edits, since he mentioned this from the beginning of our meetings about the anesthesia care provider model. Okay, submitted that in there. I think I had taken that out some time ago, but wanted to make sure that was.
Yeah, it's still in here. So it's on the document, or like in the upper, that says 16 to 42, but it's actually page 12, and it says C. Is what Dr. German is referring to. This is Blazek, and you redirected that last time.
Perfect. I, as well as Dr. Snell, did not touch the 1304 permit as it pertains to the pediatric designation. I'm just waiting on Allie's information. I think then we can tackle that permit more definitively.
This is Lau. At the last meeting, there was some requests for me as far as making some changes of the pediatric section, and I did that. I also provided a definition for a pediatric patient, and somewhere along the line, that's probably in the draft that who's the person that does the edits? What's her name?
Jessica.
Jessica. So Jessica, I guess, probably has that. So we took care of that. Of recent, though, I think the state of Florida has some guidelines regarding pediatric endorsement. They recommend the age of 7. So I don't know what the committee's going to think about that, but it seems like 7, 8 is kind of the universal thing in all the other state dental boards as far as the pediatric endorsement.
Yeah, Dr. Loudon, if I could, this is Blazek. It's funny, Eddie and I were talking about that, and we polled some of the other guys. I think that if we put it 7 and under, we actually increase safety.
Okay.
Because when we looked at our numbers for 8 and under, it was really easy. I mean, every guy is, I think a lot of guys are doing 7 and 8 and stuff. So we would improve the safety. The biggest thing that we got was how do we, are we going to submit these cases to the board or is it just affidavit? You know, so maybe logistically, I don't know if we want to talk about that now, to where every 2 years we're going to show we did 20 cases, you know, regardless of what level we are. I'm not sure if that's something to be discussed here or do we worry about that on the back end?
No, I think it's appropriate to discuss it now. And I think it should be an affidavit.
Affidavit, I'm fine with that.
I have a question about that that just comes up because I was getting ready to do a renewal for an individual and he doesn't have the 50 cases. It's kind of besides the point, but what he was saying is it 50 total for 5 years or is it 10 per year? Because he had a year where he was out for personal reasons and couldn't get the 10 that year. And when I went back and talked to Susie, it was 10 per year. So I was wondering for this, should we make it 20 for the course of 2 years? If there is a personal, you know, you're out for 6 months or something and you don't get those numbers, that may be one of those unintended consequences where that particular I didn't get it, but over the course of 2 years, I was able to get the full 20. I don't know. That just got in a conversation totally separate, but it made me start thinking about this that we're going through.
My sense is that we do over 2 years. I mean, this is the first time we're implementing anything like this for pediatrics. I know the hospitals do it over 2 years rather than per year. And then, when we sit down in 5 years from now, we look at this again and we go, well, we're having issues with these individuals and get in the details and find out that they had a year where they could do anything. And that'd be my vote.
Mr. Christensen, I agree. I think, things kind of ebb and flow sometimes with ages. And I think a 2 year span is a lot easier to manage.
And are we requiring it to be provider and anesthesiologist for that? Or if you're taking a case to the hospital and they're, 7 years old, is that going to count?
I think we can do both. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that as well.
Or if they come to your office,
I think otherwise, like we've talked about, it can discourage a provider from using the anesthesia provider in lieu of trying to get their caseload.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My next question to that would be that if we're doing that over the case of 2 years, should we change the verbiage or the number of cases for the current permits to do it over the course of a 5 year time rather than a per year time?
So this is Blake. So for clarification, this is a case where he was going for a brand new permit or just a renewal?
Renewal. 1302.
And he had 50 total cases over 5 years, but there was a year he didn't have 10.
No, he did not have 50. So it's not going to help this individual, but just got me started thinking. There was one particular where he was really low, like only did a couple cases because for personal reasons he had, he was out for a lot of the year. So it just got me thinking, man, if something happened to a provider in a certain year where they couldn't perform that, and I don't even know where he goes now. That's what Susie's going to reach out to him. But do you have to restart everything, go get more training? I don't know what that looks like. But just made me start thinking, does it make more sense to do it over the course of the full time, like John was saying, over a 2 year span or 3 year span? Or
if you go a year without doing 5 cases, how competent would you be the following year when you pick it back up?
You know, this is Blazek. One thing I've done in the past 2 evaluations is I kind of remediated them. It was a situation where they were in a practice with other providers, and I said, I'm going to give you a conditional pass. And your next 10 cases, you got to do with someone else in the office with you. Now, there's no law. There's nothing in these bylaws or statutes that tell me I can do that. I just thought that was a safe bet, that it was going to afford the individual an opportunity to get up to speed, know what's going on in the office. Maybe that's a case that, you just take it on and say, okay, here's what I think you need to do for the next 10 cases till you get up to speed. And I think that you give a provisional pass, then the board, and you say, this is the reason, this is what I want to have happen, you know, the board would support you on that.
And if that was the case, that'd be great. The answer, Dr. German's question, for me, if I, like next year I couldn't do it, I'd be totally comfortable because I've done a bazillion for the past 10, 15 years that I was comfortable. A person, it's his second year out and he barely got 10 the first year and now he didn't get, he got 2 the next year and had something happen. I think it's a completely different story. So I think it's very unique to each given circumstance.
But the idea to have some type of remediation in place is a good idea.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
And I like your approach better than having to retake a course where, frankly, those courses oftentimes, I mean, they're good initially, but I think you learn more from working with the seasoned provider mm-hmm. than taking that.
And if it's, hey, you're faulting this many for this 1 year, do remediation with someone, bring a provider in, help out for those cases to make up the difference. So it just seemed a little bit, I was just like, wow, that could happen to anyone, where in the course of 1 year, something happens, and now what?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Blazik, and again, I think this might happen in the hospital where, you know, most of the time providers are pretty open to that. I know surgeons who haven't done, you know, a frontal sinus in 10 years, a frontal sinus fracture, you know, and they're like, man, I got this frontal sinus case. You know, how should I handle it? Well, get someone who does them,
yeah.
Do them with them. And that, they typically, there's a, you know, the collegiality there,
like
there's
that.
Mentorship. I mean,
yeah.
So just take that for what it's worth. I think, you know, being as well-trained as you are and doing, say, hey, here's what I think we should do. What do you think? You know, and both those providers were totally open to it. They were like, yeah. And that was better than the alternative, which is no permit.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that would have to be written in, because as of right now, if you don't have 50, like we didn't even go do the site eval because he came to me. He's like, I don't have 50 cases. Like, and that says I have to have 50 to do a reevaluation.
Interesting. How far off was it?
Do you remember, Susie?
14
off or something. Yeah. It was mid to high 30s. I don't remember what it was.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I would have saw
it. And I'm not so much speaking to his specific case.
Mm-hmm.
More of a general idea there.
Well, we're going to run into that here. You know, we're creating something that's going to be an issue. This is Christensen. So we have to have a plan, either remediation, can they apply for an extension? You know, I don't know. We those are things we probably need to discuss.
Yeah, and I like, in the spirit of professionalism and collegiality, this is great. We did this in the hospital where we do have to be supervised if we go a certain period without the right number of cases. But I like this idea, and we talked about this a little bit with Jason Brady. If you can't get enough peds, then come work with me type of it's the mm-hmm. same idea where you can get the cases in and, you know, you can check that box off and you can move on. There's no punitive action that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to get the permit, there's a way to get it.
And, you know, this is Blazik again, and I know we talked a bit, you know, this is not on this topic, but we said, how do we really make this committee move forward? And it's like, you know, do we produce a quarterly one-page document that you guys just did again, the board did, came out and it talked about anesthesia and it asked specific questions and it was spot on. It just brought things to the forefront. You know, we can create a document and say, hey, guess how useful it is to go do some anesthesia with someone else. You know, I'm a better anesthesia provider because Matt Hanchett, which almost all you guys know that guy, I was by myself for 18 years. He comes to the office and we work together, and I am delivering better anesthesia because of him, and I think vice versa. So it's good to create this sense of let's work together to be better providers and safer providers, you know. And that came straight from the ADA, too. You know, the ADA, the president of the ADA is in Arizona right now. So his name is Dan Clemenson. He's an oral surgeon. And he said that's the real big push through the ADA is how do we really just make non-punitive engagement to advance the specialty and the safety of dentistry, you know. So I think we're going in the right direction here. One thing that I just saw here, because I know this is something that we talked about, Dr. Snell, was about the capnography. And I know you weren't real happy initially with it, but we have it in the document here for 13.01, 02, and 03.
Yeah, I think it's either or, like you have to have a
oh, you're right, it is or
a cap, yeah, which yeah. I'm okay. Yeah. I think that's
That's okay.
That allows us to monitor ventilation is what that does.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah.
That's the way it's written.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't see any with these that really didn't seem like what we've been talking about the whole time. What were the yellow little post-it notes? Was people supposed to write things in there, or that's where they made change?
That's Jessica Thomas's questions, I believe. Jessica, you can probably jump in here.
Because I click it.
If you scroll over it. So some of them will be questions, and some of them will be, like, there's one that I just scrolled over and it says Begay, which it looks like that's his change. And then there's a couple others that say whatever.
Yeah, because I'm not getting that when I scroll over. Maybe it's specific to the person who made the change.
This is Jessica. Would it be easier if I share my screen so we're all looking at the same draft and then we can all see the comments?
It would be if we had IT staff on staff so that we could show the people in the room the screen that you would like to share. What we can do, they have internet access on their
computer? If you turn your hotspot on, you could.
No.
We're going to see if we can maybe get these computers with internet access to so that they can log into the Google Meet and then share the screen that way. That's our IT solution.
Do you need it?
Thank you. Oh. I'm on here. I just scooted further away.
Of course, it's an Apple product.
But I did my hotspot.
Oh, you did? Okay, I'm going to hotspot mine right now. Yeah. Yeah. There we go.
If it shows Windows 10, then they can access it. If they don't, then they can. So I'm going to give this to Dr. Christensen.
Okay. He can have mine.
Dr. Love has Windows 10.
This is Christensen. So the bylaws that we're putting in here, either the N-Title CO2 or the... Or the pre-tracheal stethoscope. Sorry.
Cool.
1307.
So it's not in the 1302 area?
No, it's on separate.
Okay.
To renew each.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. It is required for us to have a end title in the office for our specialty.
Yeah, for general anesthetic. So, and I think we are on board with that. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And Dr. German said that too. But I think with the 1303 was the one we said or.
It's 1302.
Yeah, 1302. That's IV, right? I mean,
but it's the same level of sedation.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a question of mine. The only difference between 1302 and a 1303 is the root.
Right. I think with the 1302, what we'd be concerned about is when you reach that level more than you anticipate, and that's where capnography would be handy.
What does capnography do more than a stethoscope?
Well, I think the stethoscope, I know we talked about this last time when you said, you know, kids moving around or whatever, and it's hard for the nasal cannula to stay in. But the same thing with the precordial sometimes isn't as reliable. That's the only, you know, thing. So you have a second method to monitor, just like visual. You know, I think once you use a precordial or a capnography, again, you don't rely on pulse saturation. I mean, really, it's so delayed, right? So I find it just a second level. Because our units come all in one, I have no idea what it costs to have a separate capnography unit, but that could be a prohibitor.
Yeah, I just think we need to monitor ventilation somehow. And whether that's capnography, a precordial, I think they do the same thing. One might be trained
select capnography and see the waveform. One might training might have been a precordial and they'd select it in their ear, being able to hear it. I don't see the difference between the two. There's no delay between the two. You can hear him breathing or you can't. You can see him breathing or you can't. So I just think that I like the fact that it's like moderate ventilation, either one of those, they both do the same thing.
If Dr. Brady
one's a little more sophisticated looking, but
if Dr. Brady was here, he'd go back to the airplane analogy. You know, there's 30 dials up there, and that's because a lot of them are backups, right? You know, and so I think that's what capnography offers you. I think it does improve the safety, just because it's another method to identify ventilation.
When you do you mean in addition to a precordial?
Uh huh.
So you put a precordial on and
capnography? I personally do. Yeah.
I do too.
Yeah.
I would be in favor of requiring it. And title CO2 capnography for all sedations, personally. That's where I'm at. If we're here talking about safety, and this is one small thing that we can do, I'm all for it, personally.
I can go back and cite literature from the pediatric world that shows, even in the pedo world, they don't mandate that. But I think you need to monitor ventilation.
I don't do a whole lot of moderate sedation. But I have done a fair amount, and I have had episodes where my end-tidal CO2 has disappeared because they're breathing through the mouth. I haven't used pre-tracheal. I've used esophageal stethoscopes, but I can only imagine that you might have competing sounds or disruptive sounds that come through the pre-tracheal stethoscope. I don't know. I just don't know. But I could see where both of them in tandem would be useful. If one were to fail, you're second guessing yourself. You're wondering, was that actually breath? And you can verify with the other monitor and vice versa, that kind of stuff.
See, for me, from a moderate, is that breath sound? I don't know. Hey, Johnny. Oh, yeah, that was breath.
Okay, could you stay moderate?
Totally.
But if he's not moderate, if the patient's not moderate anymore, that's.
So then I can quickly say, hey, Johnny. No response. He's not him moderate. So then I know I need to come in and do something about that. So I just think it still provides the feedback that I need to be able to care for the patient safely. And going back to all of the cases that we reviewed, I never once saw where it would have been made a difference.
Well, none of the adverse occurrences were 1302. 1303 permit holders.
I don't see
this as well. From a pediatric moderate sedation standpoint, a lot of us about 25 years ago got the capnography units. We tried it. And almost across the board, it's just a sit still factor. Unless you try to get a tube up there where the nose or put it through the nitrous nose or anything like that, there's any movement. We were getting air breathing. So I think that's why there's been more of a push for use the pre-tracheal versus capnography. So, I mean, most of the time we're talking to kids. The kids are talking. They're breathing through the mouth a lot of them. So it's just you just don't really get good readings with the capnography. It's not to say it's not wonderful. It is. But with that population, it might be challenging.
This is Christensen. I found a lot of those pre-tracheals, they can be tough to keep on when patients are moving. You know, you have them taped to the neck or, you know, moving around. But there's still obviously end titles or can be moved and things like that too.
For that exact reason is why I think either or your provider, you should be able to make a decision, a clinical decision based on what's in front of you. If I have an end tidal, should I be using it in this case? If I have a precordial, should I be using it in this case? Is this kid screaming and crying where neither of those is going to be needed because he's giving me feedback that he's breathing just fine. And if I had to have both of those on, I just think that comes down to we need to monitor ventilation. And as the provider that's been trained, the different situations should allow you to decide what's the best monitoring device for that. And so to have them in there is an either or, I think is a great compromise for that.
So I get a sense, we could probably talk about this for the next couple hours, and I think everybody's going to stay pretty grounded where they're at. Maybe this is something that when more of the committees present, we could vote on, and then the board can get the recommendation very specifically. Unless we want to continue to talk about it.
I'm not against voting on it, you know, and I mean, if we don't kind of move forward with some of these things, then we'll just keep on coming.
We're going to just keep talking about it. That's kind of where I'm going with it.
Yeah.
It seems as though we're in agreement on almost everything here. Now we just have to get it finalized, maybe call specific items out for vote before we okay it to go to the board for approval.
Yeah.
This is Jessica. I'm now sharing the draft that should have all of the various suggestions and changes listed in the document. It might be easiest if we just start at the beginning and make our way through as suggestions and specific language requires further discussion, then you can address it at that time if that's how you want to move forward.
Yeah, I mean, we got some time. I think that'd be a good idea to do right now. Appreciate you being here. Do we know what Jessica's presenting? Is that the same packet we all have in front of us? Because other than me, no one can see what she's presenting right now.
No, we can see it.
We can see it now. Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. And if I can just jump in here real quick. So there was an initial packet of materials that went out that does not include Dr. German's comments. This one that she now probably has on her screen does, because she submitted the latest version to us Monday, which was yesterday. So this should have Dr. German's edits as well.
Okay, so if we want to just start working through the document, the first suggestion that we have is in Rule 101 relating to the definitions, and there were some suggestions to update the definition of analgesia. And please forgive my pronunciation. I don't do what you guys do, so I'm sure I'm going to ruin a lot of these technical terms. But so the suggestion was to add in means the diminution or elimination of pain, and then remove the rest of that sentence. Then there was parentheses, see ADA guidelines for the use of sedation and general anesthesia by dentists, aka ADA guidelines.
So this is now, I would take out the part, I was the one that did that edit. I just put the parentheses there for the committee to see where that came from. So I would, of the official verbiage, I would take that part out.
But the red line part.
No, the parentheses, see ADA guidelines, I would take that out.
Yeah.
That was just for the benefit of the committee to see where that, I didn't make up that definition.
Yeah, just delete it. Yeah.
Come on, Snell.
So then the question here is, do you agree with this suggestion of removing the language that's in red and including the language that's in blue?
Let me ask a question. This is German. Is there a reference section in the document? Can we just put a reference to the ADA guidelines? Just so that whoever's reading this in the future can know that this was referenced from there.
So, Mary, were you going to jump in?
Was I going to jump in? That might be a better question for Jessica, because I know they get tricky when you incorporate something by reference. Correct, Jessica?
You're absolutely correct. So the only way to do that would be to officially incorporate the definition by reference, and that comes with a whole slew of requirements that you have to meet in order to properly incorporate it. It also requires you to then maintain it if that reference ever changes or they ever change their definition and you don't agree with it or you want to stay with the old definition. I understand the purpose and the value in having that reference, but it's usually not something that I would recommend putting into the rule itself.
This is Snell. I was just teasing. I made that up. Just kidding.
I like the way the definition is. We don't need a reference. I think it's better than the previous one because analgesia is diminution or elimination of pain. You don't have to have nitrous oxide or oxygen in there with or without. We're defining analgesia. I think we're good.
All right, let's move on then.
All right. No further comments. Then we will move on to the definition of deep sedation. I don't work in this field, so I've been trying to follow along as best I can, but it appears that there are several levels of sedation, including deep sedation, moderate sedation, minimal sedation, oral sedation, and parenteral sedation. My question here is, doesn't 1304 allow a dentist to obtain a permit to employ or work with an anesthesia or sedation provider? And if that's the case, then I think that there are some changes that we can make to these rules to really simplify how anesthesia or sedation is provided in the dental office.
Well, I'm not sure that we know exactly how that 1304 verbiage is going to read yet. It's going to be partially dependent upon the stakeholder meeting and the feedback we get back from them. But as it stands right now, if a dentist has a 1304 permit, that gives them the ability to work with an anesthesia provider that can provide any level of anesthesia.
So my recommendation then would be to we leave this comment as is, because unfortunately, as much as I'm sure you all would like to call it one and done, this will probably not be the only review of these rules that you do before you go to the board. So we can leave this comment here, and then as we further develop the language in 1304 and make those decisions about, you know, how you want the anesthesia or sedation provider to operate in the dental office, we can come back to this section. My next comment here was a suggestion to add in the word usually when you're talking about cardiovascular function is usually maintained. That's a very, at least from a rule writing standpoint, for lack of a better word, wishy-washy. And I'm not sure what that means. Cardiovascular function is usually maintained. Does that mean that it must be maintained? Does that mean that there's some sort of standard to maintain it? I'm not sure what the value is in adding that usually there.
This is Lasik, and I'll make a comment maybe about both those things. One of the goals I think that Dr. Snell was making when he appropriately changed our previous permitting levels, which were defined by the route of administration, and he changed them to be defined by the level of sedation. That is a move that we did intentionally to mirror what the American Society of Anesthesiologists has done in terms of their definitions, as well as what the American Dental Association has done with their definitions. And I can tell you that the cardiovascular function is usually maintained is right out of the ASA and the ADA definitions, as well as now the American Association of Maxillofacial Surgeons. We have adopted our definitions to be exactly the same. So we're just kind of following in line with the ASA.
I appreciate that. And I certainly understand the value in mirroring those other rules or definitions. I'm just not sure what this means. Does this mean that cardiovascular function is maintained in a usual manner, that there's certain manners in which it is maintained, or that sometimes it's not maintained, but usually it is?
This is German. Let me take a shot at it. So in there, you also see about spontaneous ventilation may be inadequate. There's a bunch of mays and maybes and usuallys. This refers to the patient's ability to maintain those organ system functions under deep sedation, if that makes sense. So depending on that patient or that individual and whatever comorbidities they may or may not have and how they may or may not respond to the sedation being given, those organ system functions may not act appropriately. So I think it's imperative, and I think it's defining to keep those words in there as you talk about this level of sedation, because as a one giving the anesthesia, it's important for us to remember or to understand that our patient isn't going to act like the next patient and so forth. And we need to remember that these organ systems may or may not function how they should. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think that would cause me to ask whether these couple of sentences are even necessary in the definition of deep sedation. It sounds like when you're trying to define deep sedation, you're defining what it is, which sounds like it is a drug-induced depression of consciousness during which a patient cannot be easily aroused but responds purposely following repeated or painful stimulation. It seems to me like the rest of this is informational, but not necessarily part of the definition of what deep sedation is.
I would respectfully kind of disagree, because if we move to moderate sedation, we know then that the ability to maintain their airway is actually not as impaired, and that the likelihood of leading to cardiovascular issues is not as likely either. So I think that was one of the ideas behind that.
So we will keep usually.
Yeah.
Move on to the next suggestion, which was a definition for enteral, means any technique of administration in which the agent is absorbed through the gastrointestinal GI tract or oral mucosa, i.e. oral or sublingual. Again, see the ADA guidelines. I'm assuming that can be removed.
Yes. Should we include mucosal, nasal? No.
Technically.
I think you could include it.
Consider parenteral. Technically. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, parenteral.
Could be in, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm also going to remove these parentheses of GI tract when you're drafting rules. You typically only want to use the acronym if you're going to use that phrase later in the rules. So if we use gastrointestinal tract somewhere else, then we could, you know, add in the parentheses GI tract, but I'm not sure that it's necessary if we're not referring to that again in the rules specifically. Similarly with the brackets here of i.e. oral or sublingual.
Take it out?
Correct.
Cool.
My suggestion. All right. Hearing no further discussion, we'll move on. So we are now at the definition of minimal sedation. There were a few suggested changes to that definition. There was also a question from Dr. Snell, I believe, about addressing multiple dosing.
So my question with them is it okay later on, not right here, but later on with the 1303, there's a currently something that says you can give, I'd have to go back and read it, like you can give up to the maximum recommended dose for at-home use in conjunction with nitrous, and then if you need to, you can give an half of what you just gave, as long as it doesn't exceed 1.5 times the maximum recommended dose, all without any sedation permit. So it's multiple dosings of stuff without a sedation permit. Intended to still, and then it clarifies that it still has to stay within a minimal sedation anxiolysis type of setting. So that is a caveat to it. But my question was just, is minimal sedation multiple dosing to stay within minimal sedation? Is that really, I don't know. Just a question, a thought. I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other.
Be pretty unpredictable.
I think when we start talking about technique, that's probably going to come later on, or right now.
Yeah, definition of that, I think it applies.
I want you to leave the definition and we'll get to the technique. Yeah.
That's what she was referencing. That was my question, though, where it stems from the mental sedation later on.
So is this a question that is more appropriately addressed when we get to the 1303?
Yeah, I think so.
But as far as the definition as written. Is that something we can okay right now?
Absolutely.
With the struck out language?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. And same with moderate sedation. Also the same question about addressing multiple dosing. We'll look at that when we get to 1303. Other than that, how do you feel about the suggestions of removing this language in red and adding?
This is Blazik. So Heath, did you copy that from the ADA too?
I believe so.
Cause I would think reflex withdrawal.
What we're talking about, moderate sedation, right?
Yeah.
So let me read you what the ADA guideline says and you read what's written there.
Okay.
It says, a drug induced depression of consciousness during which patients respond firstly to verbal commands, either alone or accompanied by light tactile stimulation. No interventions are required to maintain a patent airway and spontaneous ventilation is adequate. Cardiovascular function is usually maintained.
Yep. So they didn't put down reflex withdrawal. Then I'd leave it, I guess. Like you have it, I like it then.
Okay.
What are your thoughts, John?
I think it looks good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so no further comments. Moving on to definition of nitrous oxide. And could one of you please say that word for me so that I know how to say that?
You said it right.
Nitrous oxide analgesia?
Thank you. Yes. Okay. So nitrous oxide analgesia means the use of nitrous oxide N2O in combination with oxygen O2 as an inhalation analgesic?
Analgesic, yeah.
Analgesic. Thank you.
Good.
I would also recommend removing
the parentheses.
Mm-hmm. Any further discussion on nitrous oxide? All right, hearing none, moving down to oral sedation. There were several suggestions on changes for this definition. Including one over here in the side comment that Dr. Snell also referenced. It looked like maybe he was suggesting changing oral sedation to enteral sedation.
Yeah, that was early on when we were looking at doing some different things. So you can strike that and just stick with the oral sedation because enteral sedation wasn't defined. So we've defined it now. So you can strike that.
Okay. And then how do we feel about the suggested changes to oral sedation?
Can we talk a bit about this is Blazik, we have in here, not to exceed moderate sedation. How did we add that in there? Or how did we come up with that?
This is Snell. I just put that in because everywhere in the remainder of the document, when oral sedation was mentioned, it was in reference to 1303. And so I didn't want to confuse that 1303 permit holders should be doing deep sedation, but I'm totally okay taking that out because that's where the reference came from was for that. So, but if someone wants to use oral sedation to do deep sedation there, I don't know that we need to be prescribing that they can't. I don't know that anyone who provides deep sedation would use that route, but.
Patient will never wake
up. Right. Well, is the document created to ensure that the board is protected, that if someone inadvertently thinks they can do oral sedation to a moderate or deep sedation, that they would do that without, no, I guess not.
I mean, this is the definition section, right? I mean,
right.
I think that those details should be discussed within the department level.
Okay.
I would think.
All right.
Do you agree with that?
So yeah. Do you want to take that part out?
Take that out.
I would recommend taking that out.
Yeah, take it out. Yeah, this is definition parental. I think that stays.
So now your definition will read, oral sedation is the enteral administration of a drug to achieve sedation. Oh, sorry, to achieve a desired level of sedation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Help, to help achieve? I don't know.
It should say to help.
Sometimes they don't get the desired sedation they want. But.
We're happy with oral sedation?
Looks good.
Yeah, okay. We're good with that.
All right, moving on to parenteral sedation. Lots of removal, a little bit of added language here. So parenteral sedation means the administration of a drug outside the gastrointestinal tract and is used to achieve a desired level of sedation. And then you have examples here. I would recommend removing the examples.
Yeah, that looks good.
Okay. So we're okay with how parenteral sedation looks?
Yeah. You think you ought to match up with oral, though? I mean, in parenteral, it says is used to achieve. And we could say that the same. They'd match up, be a little bit more consistent.
Mm-hmm.
The internal administration of a drug is used to achieve a desired level of sedation. That way they'd be essentially the same, just the route different.
I would maybe say, if we did that, Mrs. Blazek, I would say a desired level of sedation or general anesthesia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
Did we?
Yeah.
Okay, and that matches with the definition of general anesthesia?
No.
A drug-induced loss of consciousness during which the patient is not arousable, even by painful stimulation?
Yeah, the way we get general anesthesia is through parenteral administration. So okay. They are consistent. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now you've got oral sedation is the enteral administration of a drug to achieve a desired level of sedation. Then you have parenteral sedation means the administration of a drug outside the gastrointestinal tract to achieve a desired level of sedation or general anesthesia.
To match oral sedation, do you want to just say is the administration?
Yeah, take out means and just say is the. Mm-hmm. I thought the same thing.
This is good stuff. Doing well.
We're flying through this document.
All right. So I had a comment here that Dr. Snell suggested the following language. Is this also an older comment that we don't need to address?
I can't see it. The one in purple?
No,
this one
here. Technique.
Yeah. Yeah, that's older.
Okay.
Oh, up there. Oh, yeah.
All right, that brings us down to pediatric endorsement. So I had a question here about whether it should be defined, and then in a later version of suggestions that was submitted, there was a suggested definition of a provision added to 1301, 1302, 1303, and 1304 permit holders allowing administration of sedation or general anesthesia to patients 8 years of age or younger.
So we're going to change that to 7 years of age and younger.
Right. This is Lout. That was the definition that the pediatric subcommittee put together. I think that's the one you'll want to go with, Jessica, with Dr. German's suggestion of 7 years of age or younger.
Okay.
What do you guys think? It says so endorsement to provide sedation or anesthesia services or procedures. we don't necessarily need a pediatric endorsement to perform procedures.
Procedures,
yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
We can take procedures out.
So I would probably take out the purple and just put the blue in there.
Okay. So.
And start from pediatric endorsement is provision added to the different permits and so on and so on.
This is Christensen. I know we discussed it before, but are we, you know, one of the concerns is about some of the rural practicing, even for that matter, those in the city too, that, you know, if there's a 5 or 6 year old that comes in with a abscess, you know, that could be drained pretty quickly. They don't have a pediatric endorsement. They were asking if we talked a little bit about if they provide some sort of minimal sedation or moderate sedation to be able to get them through that procedure. How are we going to verbalize that? Are we agreed to move forward with something along those lines? It gives a little.
Maybe we should swing back around to that when we get to the permit.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of put that back out there. Thanks.
Okay, so I have a few suggestions on this definition. So Section 1301 permit and the rest of them that follow are all defined terms. So when you refer to them, it would be best if we refer to them as their defined term, which is Section 1301 permit, Section 1302 permit, et cetera. And really, is it necessarily a provision that's being added to the permit holders, or is it a provision that's being added to their permit?
I don't think we've figured that out yet. It could be added, or it could be a separate permit.
Okay.
So this is Blazik. So just a comment out loud. So what we're asking is, or what we're, so we already have all these 1301, 1302, and 1303 permit holders out there. They're already practicing, and they're kind of putting people to sleep that they want to. We're going to add a requirement to their current permit, as well as anybody getting a new permit from here going forward, that indicates if you're going to do a patient 7 years of age or younger, you need to have this endorsement. So defining or saying it in that fashion, does that help maybe in, you know, that it's not necessarily a separate permit, it's just something we're adding to their current permit or to anyone coming in? If you want to do 7 years of age or younger, you need the pediatric endorsement. Did that help in the definition, Jessica, or?
Yeah, so I'm trying to follow you guys in what you're trying to do and then put it into the right rulemaking format to achieve the end goal. And it sounds like you're determining whether there should be a separate permit for the pediatric application of anesthesia or sedation versus just adding a provision to each of those permits that already exists that would allow them to do anesthesia or sedation on a pediatric patient who's 7 years or younger. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not really a separate permit.
I would say the idea would be to add it from what we've discussed thus far.
Yeah. I mean, are there true pros and cons to adding versus creating a separate permit?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, and I'd ask Ryan if it's from a logistics standpoint, if one would impact board staff more than another.
I think that creating a whole new license might be more work. But like if you had an endorsement, it could be similar to
maybe added on your,
like a motorcycle license on an already existing license.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Because I don't think the outcome is any different. So whatever accomplishes it,
I think Christensen. Yeah, I think I would agree. I think everybody has their permit. I think they can then be issued this endorsement because the permits are renewed every 3 years on their birthday right? And this is an
five years
for the license, but we're trying to review every 2 years. So we wouldn't want to have to reprint licenses because they didn't get that within that 5 year period. So you'd be reprinting things versus you send the endorsement out to them every 2 years, you know, that they're renewing.
And just to clarify, this is only for the 1301 or
all the permits.
Okay.
Even the 1302.
Well, 1304, I think we might, I would leave it in here, but that may go away.
Yeah.
I mean,
does that help? We're leaving it in for the
1302,
Jessica? But it's probably not going to be used
right.
Much.
Right. That's what
yes.
I don't know. I honestly don't know anyone.
You and I do moderate sedation on
a 6-year old that's wiggling
yeah.
around.
Right.
You shouldn't be doing moderate sedation.
Right.
Or trying to start an IV. Yeah. Yeah.
That was kind of.
But it's there just in case. Yeah.
But a couple of topics, this is Blazing, a couple of topics to think about. I know I'm really liking what we're doing here, narrowing this in, but we need to think about how long we're going to give people to get this permit. This endorsement, and we also need to think about how we inform everybody of this new rule.
Let's circle back
on that,
the definition,
yeah.
and then get to those.
Yeah,
and I derailed that as well.
Right. Thanks for keeping us dialed in here.
Yeah, I got it. Okay, Jessica. After hearing that, do you have a recommendation on how to define this better?
Yeah, I would start with this. Pediatric endorsement is a provision added to one of those permits, 1301, 1302, 1303, and 1304, allowing administration of sedation or general anesthesia to a pediatric patient who is 7 years of age or younger, according to, because that's where you're going to have the requirements to get the endorsement and what standards of care you have to maintain in order to continue using that endorsement under those permit provisions.
That's good. I like that.
Okay.
I like it.
All right.
Okay. And like I said, this is just your first bite at the apple.
What?
All right.
I eat my apple all at once.
I'm done after that. Yeah. You know, I don't come back for seconds.
All right. So here is the next question that I had. Please forgive me, but I read through a lot of rules for different folks in different areas of practice. But my question is, do we need to define pediatric patient? And the reason for that is I believe in some situations, a pediatric patient isn't necessarily someone who's under 18. It could also be someone who is incapacitated or not functioning at an adult level, if that makes sense.
This is Lau. I think since we're doing sedation, general anesthesia, that we should narrow it to pediatric patient as an individual less age 7 years or younger. I think if you start going with the pediatric definition from like the American Academy of Pediatrics, or if you start looking at special needs, it's going to get pretty complicated.
Mm-hmm. And this is Christensen. Can you kind of define? Can we kind of define it in regards to this endorsement that we're placing? That you know,
think,
according to this endorsement.
That's what I suggested
yeah.
that way.
Yeah.
7 years of age.
This is Snell. Jesse, from what you read in the one before, it pretty much, in my mind, outlines 7 years or under. Do we need to have a further definition that defines a pediatric patient? Because it's only in context of this endorsement. And I think that definition was pretty clear with what you read before.
I'm kind of with Dr. Snell. I mean, pediatric patients are very well defined. Pediatrics are well defined.
Yeah.
And you know, certainly 11-year-old is not the same as a 30-year-old and so forth. And so I would recommend that we define pediatric patient because we're all going to take care of pediatric patients without the endorsement. But to actually take care of 7 and younger, we have to have an endorsement.
Mm-hmm.
Because we believe for a number of reasons that that age group is much different than the other pediatric patients.
So
the committee wanted to find that as age 7 and younger? Is that what we want to go with?
Yeah, I think
is
you
that the consensus?
Mirror it.
Yeah. Okay.
Or eliminate.
I would eliminate it. It would be my recommendation.
I'm not opposed to that.
With the original definition that Jessica had just read to us.
That's fine. That's
so,
this is Christensen. Could somebody read that, though, and just say a little bit? Like I said, there's, like John was saying, there's a lot of definitions to pediatric patients.
So pediatric endorsement is a provision added to those section permits allowing the administration of sedation or general anesthesia to a pediatric patient who is 7 years of age or younger. And then it goes on to reference those rules. I would my first gut reaction is to agree that we don't necessarily need to define pediatric patient because it's clear that for the pediatric endorsement, it's only for children who are 7 and younger. However, when you do a search for pediatric patient throughout the rules, the first one that pops up is this deep sedation or general anesthesia for pediatric patients. And in that situation, I mean, whenever we refer to pediatric patient, are we only referring to someone who is 7 or younger? Or are there places?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so either. I think that there are other places where you're referring to pediatric patients who may be, you know, 8 through 18.
Right.
And if that's the case, then I think you're actually fine. I don't think you should define pediatric patient as 7 years or younger. I think you should go with a common usage. And that's the way that rules work is if you don't specifically define something and it's not specifically defined for you in statute or Mary in case law, then you're left with the common usage. And so I think the common usage of a pediatric patient in this instance would be okay, especially because you have the pediatric endorsement specifically referencing for 7 years or younger.
I like that idea.
Okay, good. Let's do that. Move along.
Okay. We are moving along. So here is where we start getting into the definitions of the permits themselves. Section 1301 permit. Dr. Snell suggested the following. This is where we start changing the definitions to the levels instead of.
Yeah, Jeff, you can strike all the level. Any that was early on, and we decided not to go that direction. It just didn't get taken out.
Okay. Okay, so my next question on the Section 1301 permit, the current definition reads that a Section 1301 permit means a permit to administer general anesthesia and deep sedation, employ or work with a physician anesthesiologist, or employ or work with a certified registered nurse anesthetist?
Yep.
Okay. Under Article 13, and then my question, again, in looking at trying to simplify the rules is, should this really just be an anesthesia or sedation provider throughout the rules? And then you can define anesthesia or sedation provider as a physician anesthesiologist or a certified registered nurse anesthetist. Or you could define it even more broadly, which I think might be even more helpful, which is to say, an anesthesia or sedation provider is anyone who is licensed by the state to provide anesthesia or sedation services. And then it doesn't matter if they're licensed by the medical board versus the nursing board, as long as they're licensed by the state to provide those services, they can provide them.
I like your idea about keeping it vague in the definition of Section 1301 permit as far as anesthesia provider. But when defining anesthesia provider, I think we need to be a little more specific. Just as an example, Jason Brady gave us an example of EMTs providing sedation in dental offices in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that can open up a can of worms with different people who feel like they're qualified to give sedation and then popping up in offices here and there. So I think we need to be specific there.
Yeah, this is Christensen too. I think to employ or work with a 1301 permit holder, shouldn't we strike that from the, 1301 permits don't necessarily, I mean, a general dentist isn't
able to get a 1301 permit to have to be able to work with a physician assistant or a CRNA. I don't know why we have employer work with.
If you had a case where you wanted to bring in a MD anesthesiologist,
you want to leave
the 1304 permit for that.
No. But you would never want to bring someone in and help you on a case?
Well, we already have my own 1301 permit.
Yeah. I know. So if you have that permit, then this is saying it allows you to do that.
Okay. Okay.
I think you leave it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Blazek. I'd echo Dr. German. So let's tie this up. Let's change the verbiage you have here, but then let's go back and define what an anesthesia provider is. Maybe we should do that now.
I think you should put in the specialties that can provide what they
have.
Yeah, the 1301 permit. We should be very specific then, maybe, you know, to Dr. German's point. So that the dental anesthesiologist that should be added?
Well, we're going to define an anesthesia provider, and then we'll list the dental anesthesiologist, we'll list a physician anesthesiologist, we'll list a CRNA, we'll list
oral surgeon,
maxillofacial surgeon.
Jessica, I would probably just say an anesthesia provider because that encompasses sedation as well.
Yeah, I would agree. Yep.
Just for simplicity's sake.
Yeah.
Is this just looking forward? Because the 1302 has the exact same terminology. Are we going to include general dentists in the 1302 so that someone could go in and provide moderate sedation? If you just define it as an anesthesia provider and carry that through, then that eliminates someone like myself to go into Dr. Hero's office that has a 1302 and provide moderate sedation for him.
But you have your own permit to do that, so it wouldn't really matter.
So then I couldn't have a CRNA?
You could.
I could.
Yeah. That's the intent. The intent is not to change that.
So do you need to...
But I think it's less important to define the dental anesthesiologist going into an oral surgeon's office because they both have 13.
So that was going to be my next question. So is it just that is an anesthesia provider just need to be an outside of the dental world anesthesia provider? Because any other dental anesthesia provider should have their own permit.
1301 permit.
Yeah. Yeah.
As well as an oral surgeon.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets kind of hairy because then, well, you are an anesthesia provider and you're not listed under anesthesia.
Well, if this 1304 thing works out, you could just say a 1304 permitted anesthesia provider or something like that.
Yeah.
And then in the rules address that 1301 and 2 can employ and 3 can employ or work with MD or CRNA without having to obtain the 1304.
Right.
But as it stands right now, anesthesia provider in all of these permits, correct me if I'm wrong, he can still be defined as the CRNA anesthesiologist because everyone else in the dental world already has access to the sedation permit.
Right.
Maybe we should limit it to that.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
So a non-dental anesthesia provider is that what that would be defined as.
Yeah,
that's actually not a bad idea. Can employ a non-dental anesthesia provider.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then we define non-dental anesthesia provider as physician anesthesiologist or certified registered nurse anesthetist.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, physician anesthesiologist is the same MD or DO, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, I just need some place to begin in defining this. So.
Yeah, so how about it means any anesthesia provider that does not hold a dental license, including a medical anesthesiologist or a CRNA, certified registered nurse anesthetist. So
do we want to say including or limited to? Because if it's any non-dental, then you get an EMT.
I think limited. I think limited to. Yeah. So you have a non-dental anesthesia provider means any anesthesia provider. That is not licensed by the dental board. Or is not, doesn't have a dental license, maybe, if I should say. Limited to.
Non-licensed dental providers. Non-licensed dental providers.
I think Dr. German suggested a boarded.
Board eligible / board certified.
Yeah.
I don't know that we ever stipulate that, right? But you don't want someone who's.
We do that under the 1301 when people are getting it. We say eligible. Don't we? I think we talk about boarding. No, we don't.
That's a good point, though. Because I've heard of even like ER doctors going into dental offices and providing the not a different state, but all the same.
So I have a question because I'm trying to dig down into what the goal is here. What if one of you holds a 13, and I'm probably going to get the numbers wrong, but one of you holds a 1301 and the other one holds a 1302, and the 1301 holder wants the 1302 dentist to come in and help with the anesthesia. Would that be allowed?
Only to the level of the 1302.
Yeah.
Right.
Technically.
Right. Okay. And so I guess what I'm trying to get at is that when you're looking at the permit and allowing someone to, where did it go? When you're looking at means a permit to administer general anesthesia and deep sedation, employ or work with, that could still be someone who is a dental professional, right?
Yeah, so I would say a dental or a non-dental anesthesia provider. I would add that.
In which case, my next question would be, what sort of fail-safe or check do you have that the dental or non-dental anesthesia provider has the right experience and license and qualifications to provide anesthesia?
That's up to the permit holder to take responsibility for that. So the permit holder, they're supposed to be the ones ensuring that the provider is properly licensed.
Properly licensed in what
way? Or permitted in the case of the dental side.
So, Jessica, this is German. I think it's implicit in these permits that a 1302 is able to administer that moderate level of sedation no matter where they end up going. At least it looks like that. Permit to administer moderate sedation through X route, et cetera, and they can employ or work with the non-dental anesthesia provider. So I think the target here is the non-dental anesthesia provider. I don't know that, unless you guys disagree, that you need to put in their language that says to work with a dental provider and or. I think it's already implied that those permitted dentists can provide that sedation in dental offices. Is that?
Yeah, I would agree with
correct?
That. Yeah. To the level they're permitted or?
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm trying to get at. I don't know that it's necessary to distinguish between a dental versus a non-dental anesthesia provider. I think anesthesia provider would, in theory, cover both dental and non-dental, so long as they are properly permitted or licensed. And that's kind of where I was going with the definition of anesthesia provider being something along the lines of, you know, whether they're dental or non-dental, it's a provider of anesthesia services who is licensed, you know, or permitted. And I would think you would want them licensed or permitted by the state, which would include, you know, you as the dental board and your dentists and dental professionals. It would also include any of the nurses and how they are licensed to provide sedation and anesthesia, doctors, I'm assuming that even EMTs, in the case of Florida, have some sort of certification or license or permit issued by the state, or I guess possibly the city or region that they're working in, that allows them to provide emergency anesthesia or sedation services. So I guess my suggestion and what I was trying to get at was that there's some sort of umbrella that you can describe here that would say, yes, if you're licensed in this state or in any other state to provide anesthesia services, then you can work with one of these permit holders. And I believe Matthew had a question. He had his hand.
Dr. Arnold, you want to go ahead?
Yes, thank you very much. You just kind of echoed what I wanted to say, but I think for someone reading this, you know, a dentist reading this, looking to employ someone in their office to provide anesthesia, I think it would either need to say employer work with a dental or non-dental anesthesia provider, or just say work with an anesthesia provider. Because before I had a 1301 permit, I was a general dentist and I was looking to employ people. And, if I had read it and it had said employer work with a non-dental anesthesia provider, it would have confused me and probably as I read it, I probably would have thought that a dental anesthesia provider either wasn't an option or I guess what I'm trying to say is you either have to spell out both or you have to spell out neither. Does that make sense?
This is German. I tend to agree with you. If we were just to put anesthesia provider and then the definition of anesthesia provider would include permitted dentists and physician anesthesiologist and CRNA.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
It would be those three groups.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to say licensed by the state or board eligible / board certified, that's totally fine. I wouldn't extend it to any licensed sedation entity because I think then we start to open up doors that we don't want to have open at this point.
I would, as I read this, I would question the need to put any of it in. I mean, we're defining the 1301 permit. So what's a 1301 permit? It means a permit to administer generally anesthesia and deep sedation. The part of employing a non-dental or dental anesthesia provider can be spelled out under the permit that's allowed. But if we're just defining a 1301 permit, we don't have to specify who they're working with.
That's true.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that's a good point. Like maybe this isn't the place to define all that because you're right. We're just saying these permits allow this type of provision of anesthesia.
What do you think of that, Jessica?
So I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think the goal is to make it clearer how someone provides anesthesia services in the dental setting. I think that changing the permit language when we define that permit to say that they can essentially work with an anesthesia provider and then clarify what an anesthesia provider is, I think will save a lot of time in trying to repeat that in each section, permit section, if that makes sense. So you basically put it all out there in the definition section one time, and then it's going to apply to each of those sections. Unless you want different anesthesia providers to be allowed based on the level of the permit.
Defining the anesthesia provider is a fine idea. I just don't think that fits in the definition of a 1301, 1302, or 1303 permit. Because the 1301 permit is giving the dentist the ability to administer deep sedation and general anesthesia. It has nothing to do with his ability to employ or work with another anesthesia provider.
My understanding is that the purpose of the permit is exactly that. It's either to permit them to do it themselves or to work with someone. And I believe Jason had a question. He had his hand up.
Hi guys. I am so sorry. I'm just now kind of chiming in. I had an urgent case that popped up last night. So I got kind of stuck not being able to come. I tend to agree with you, Anthony. I apologize for not being there. But, you know, we have to be very careful because anesthesia, even though, like, we're trying to define anesthesia providers, I tend to agree with you that anesthesia is also a dental procedure. It is considered a dental procedure. So it doesn't seem correct to try to define that within the 1301, 1302. For the dentist permit, because it is the permit for that dentist for extending their ability to do a dental procedure, which happens to be anesthesia. And I know that sounds like we're getting into the nuance of it, but I have seen where that language can have kind of unintended consequences down the road. It sure did when we were looking at that in Mississippi from the time they first had that language and then totally rewriting regulation 29 because of it. So I do think we have to have some caution on, you know, putting everyone in the same umbrella for providers that we're able to permit or not permit, that are distinguished by being a dentist or not being a dentist by their dental license.
So
thank you, Dr. Brady.
Here's what I would suggest. If for no other reason, then it simplifies your definition and it minimizes repetition. You can change the language in each of these permit sections where it talks about employ or work with a physician anesthesiologist or employ or work with a certified registered nurse anesthetist under Article 13. You can remove that same language from each of these section definitions, put an anesthesia provider, and then that language that you're removing about the physician anesthesiologist or the CRNA, you can put that into the definition of anesthesia provider. And then as we work through the rules, if there are more types of anesthesia providers that need to be listed, we can do so. And that way you're only having to lay it out in one place. You don't have to keep repeating it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things we could do to safeguard that is just label them as a non-dentist anesthesia provider and have that definition fall within that term.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds pretty good, Jessica.
Okay, so what I'll do is I will take this language. And this will at least give us a starting point for our definition of anesthesia provider. And then we can add to it. As we go. Okay, and then I can make the same changes throughout all of these here. So now you've got Section 1302 permit means a permit to administer moderate sedation via a parenteral route of administration, employ or work with an anesthesia provider. Under Article 13.
I worry that that's confusing in that I still don't think we need to put employer work with an anesthesia provider in these. I don't think it belongs in this section, and I think it also creates confusion as to the level of sedation and anesthesia the physician and the CRNA can provide with a 1302 and 1303 permit holder.
This is Blazek, and I think, you know, what's interesting here, when I bring this up, I think you'll agree, these are old documents from back when we would make the dentist get the 1301,
right,
even though he wasn't doing the anesthesia. And that's the original behind these things. So I agree, we should just delete that employer work with. I mean,
yeah.
That's way back. That's 2003 through 2007 stuff.
And should we even go with the route, defining the route as well?
What's that?
Should we talk about minimum and moderate sedation? And we're talking about the,
I don't think
the route should even be in there either. Take out the employment and the work and the route, just the depth, minimum and moderate.
Well, 1303 is not minimum, it's moderate.
1303 is moderate?
1303 is an enteral sedation.
Oh, the enteral, okay.
I guess that's up for debate if you want to change that level, but it's always been a oral moderate sedation type of permit.
So the definition would read like 1301 permit means a permit to administer general anesthesia and deep sedation, period, right?
Yeah.
And then 1302 would be means a permit to administer moderate sedation via parenteral route.
Parenteral or enteral.
Or enteral.
Well, we know
you're
not going to use enteral. I mean, or don't even put it in.
Well, I don't think you need to put it in there because you can always go to the permit below you.
Let's leave it out then.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's, again, where the under each
permit. Down later.
We discussed that.
Yeah, delete employer work with Jessica. Delete that.
Talk about it down there.
I agree.
So the consensus, Jessica, is to remove any language about the anesthesia provider in these 1302, 1, 2, and 3 permit definitions.
So does that mean then that the only purpose for these permits is to allow the dental professional to administer this particular level of sedation themselves?
No.
Great question.
Because it seems to me it has two purposes. It's to allow if they get a 1302 permit, that means they can either do the moderate sedation themselves or they can bring in somebody to do it. But the point is that they have the permit to allow them to bring somebody in to do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. So maybe I could leave that anesthesia provider in there.
Which would necessitate leaving in the employer work with as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Looks good. This apple's turning brown.
Okay, so it sounds like you guys are good with the 1302. That brings us to the 1303, means a permit to administer. And here there was a question of whether we should get rid of oral and use minimal, or whether we should get rid of both of those and just use moderate, although moderate was already used in 1302.
03 should just be minimal.
So we're completely changing that definition where a 1303 provider cannot provide moderate sedation. That's what you're defining by doing that.
Yeah.
Because it's always been moderate, though.
It's always been moderate via an oral administration.
Mm, I see.
My vote would be to keep it at moderate.
I would stick with
it. Okay.
But.
So you have two. So the 1303 and the 1302 are essentially the same level of anesthesia, just how it's routed.
Right.
Okay, so it is moderate. It's the same. It's just a different difference of how it's being administered.
Correct.
Okay.
Which I think actually should help those that have a 1303 to realize there's this conception out there that it's just oral sedation. I'm just giving some pills. Well, no, we're giving you the, like, you need to have all this stuff because we know that you're could do moderate sedation. Right now, I think there's many providers that do oral sedation, quote unquote, in quotes.
Especially when they add additional doses.
Yeah, exactly. So.
So are you agreeing with the language or are you
suggesting?
Yes, suggest-
I agree. Sorry. Okay. Sorry, Jessica.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion on section 1303?
Nope.
Cool.
I do have one comment. As it's written right now, a general dentist who holds no sedation permit can bring in a 1301 or 1302 permit holder to provide anesthesia in their office. And that's, you know, obviously that's done under the permit of the provider that comes in. And so when we're writing in to the 1301, 1302, 1303, that that also allows them to employ an anesthesia provider to come in. I assume that still means that the general dentist can continue to bring in a 1301 or 1302 permit holder.
And we're not even talking now.
Dr. Arnold, we're kind of in definitions right now. We'll circle back around to that when it's more fitting in the agenda.
Okay.
Okay, Jessica, you can move forward.
We may need to table 1304.
Yeah, I think you leave it like it is, and then, to move. Right.
Maybe this is good pausing.
I think it is. It's 4. I keep trying to scroll.
I'm like, why is my first screen frozen?
All right, well, I know why.
What's next? Jessica, I think we're going to leave 1304 as it is, just because there's a lot of stuff happening with that permit.
And you could, your comment about 1305, you can just get rid of it. We took care of that too, I think. But thanks for being so, you got it down. You got everything in there.
And you're muted right now, Jessica. You may know that, but if you're speaking, we cannot hear you.
Sorry, thank you. Okay, yes, I removed it, and I try to stay up to date on your suggestions. Okay, so that brings us to Rule 305. You are done with the definitions. Congratulations. Okay, so 1305.
If I can jump in here. Can I jump in here real quick? We have to pause for a second because we don't have a quorum.
Okay.
Yeah, we do because Dr. Brady.
Oh, Dr. Brady's on. Never mind. And then Mary is going to be available for legal advice, but she has to adjourn herself at 4:30.
Okay. We'll probably wrap up around then anyway.
Yeah, we're pretty close.
Okay, Jessica, go ahead.
Okay, so we're in 305, application processing procedures, issuance, denial, and renewal of the section 1301, 1302, 1303, and 1304 permits. The suggestion was to remove general anesthesia, deep sedation permits, and actually reference the permits themselves, which
sounds
I agree
good.
With. Any comment or suggestion on that?
No, that looks good. No, that's a great idea.
Okay. Then moving on in subsection A,
You have the board office shall complete an administrative completeness review within 24 days from the date of the receipt of an application for a permit, within 14 calendar days of receiving an initial or renewal application, and again, removing that language and referring to the permit, which are defined themselves. Moving along, there were no other suggestions in 305. Was there anything else that you would like to discuss in 305 before we move on? Okay. Hearing none, then we will move on. That brings us to Rule 406, anesthesia and sedation permit fees. Okay, we had a suggestion from Dr. Snell, replacing A1 through 4 with $300 plus $25 for each additional location for the levels of the permits, excluding the mobile permit. Is this suggestion still valid and something that you would like the committee to discuss?
I think that's just what's written in there. Each of the permits are 300.
You just consolidate.
It's just consistent, yeah.
And to consolidate it,
yeah.
One comment, yeah.
Okay. So if you want it consolidated, I can do that.
Yeah, let's do that. Makes sense. This is Ryan.
Okay. And of course, not using the levels terminology, but the actual permit terminology.
Correct.
Themselves. Okay.
Welcome
back, Christian.
Thank you.
Is the one difference is the 1304 with a 25 for each additional location? So you're consolidating 1 through 3. Is that correct?
I believe so. And then changing number 4 in the consolidation, it would be a number 2.
Sounds good.
And again, then also excluding the mobile permit. Okay. Also suggesting removal of the expedited 1304 permit. I think we can get rid of this, the
yeah,
section 1305 permit. And so then no permit fee for an expedited 1304, right?
Right.
We're getting rid of that. Okay. All right, and then 300. All right, and then in C, we're looking at permit renewal fees. And this is basically the same consolidation as we saw before.
Can we talk about the fee thing real quick and how it applies to the mobile permit? And is there any reason to have a difference, or is it, how does it work currently with mobile permits?
The way that it works currently with the mobile is that anytime they do a application, it includes one permit. That can either be a mobile permit or it can be a designated one to hang on the wall. So if they want one to hang on the wall and a mobile, they would need to pay the extra because the $300 fee includes one.
I see. So a person applying for a mobile permit, they just have one application fee technically, and they can go wherever they want to any office.
Right, because they signed the affidavit.
Okay. So because it's interesting, because I think that's one of the, you know, things that I've been seeing with the evaluations is although the doctor is only working in 2 or 3 locations, they apply for a mobile, so they save $75, I guess, which is interesting. Is there any added pressure on the board for like a mobile permit process as opposed to just a traditional permit? No? Okay, so there's no reason for any additional cost for mobile as opposed to a traveling. So
my question is, why do we distinguish between the two? And if we, like, again, just to simplify stuff, if there's no difference and people are starting to do that where I have three, I own three offices, I want to do sedation out of all three. Oh, I know about this mobile permit. Let me just get a mobile permit. Well, why do we have two different types of permits? Either let's define mobile as something really that really is mobile, or let's just.
Well, this,
we should talk about it when we get there.
Yeah.
This is Brady. I would say it's a little bit more involved than just that, because with a mobile permit, you're testifying that you are compliant with all the equipment and standards and things that are in place for every location. So I do think there's a kind of a delineation there. So, I mean, me personally, I like the way that it's been. I think it's worked well. So I'm not quite sure to, mix that with just the 1301 in itself. But maybe it can be convinced otherwise. I'm just not seeing it right now, though.
And I think this is something we can talk about when we actually get there.
Okay, so it sounds like mobile permit will be a discussion later on.
Yes.
That will bring us down to 601, duties and qualifications. Oh, I'm sorry. There was one more comment. I believe it was a suggestion from a guy. Does this expressly authorize these additional fees?
What?
So he's referring to the statute 32-1207, and whether or not that statute expressly authorizes the additional fee, meaning I'm assuming for each additional location is the issue here. I don't know if staff maybe has an answer to that or.
So in 1207, and I am not there just yet, but that's where it talks about what the board shall do, and it gives multiple different things that the board shall do. One is establish fees, and you establish fees and rule. So, I mean, I don't know that it expressly allows it, but it allows the board to establish fees, and you do that in rule. So I'm going to say yes.
Brian, this is Mary, and Jessica probably knows too. I think it doesn't the specific fee have to be authorized under 41-1008?
I believe it does.
And what fee are they talking about? The mobile dentistry?
Just a permit fee for sedation.
Yeah. I think what Allie the guy was getting at was the additional cost of another permit. So the $25 fee.
Let's see there. And so it's not in the rule now.
So
no, it is.
Yeah, I'm looking at 1207 subsection E, and it's the board by rule shall require that a licensee obtain a permit for the application of general anesthesia, semi-conscious sedation, or conscious sedation. Shall establish and collect a fee of not more than $300 to cover administrative costs connected with issuing the permit, and shall conduct inspections to ensure compliance.
Yeah. So that should be fine then.
Okay. It looks like Jason had a question.
I think. I don't believe Ali is with us today, but I believe that the issue that he had there, and that ties into trying to permit them at the same level. So if they were able to get like a 1301 permit with the mobile designation, then I think his issue with that would go away because it'd be irrelevant. That's why. But that's a different discussion. But I believe that's why he has that flagged. I remember him talking to me in person saying some of what he felt the inequalities were between
the non-dentist anesthesia provider.
Okay, so it sounds like the issue and the question that we had about whether or not the fees are specifically authorized under that statute is null. We think that the statute does cover us.
Correct.
Okay. So any further discussion on the fees section? Hearing none, we're moving down to Rule 601, which is duties and qualifications. Oh, no changes. That's exciting. So unless someone wants to open up discussion on this rule, we can actually remove the whole rule from this draft because you're not making any changes.
Oh, sounds good.
Okay. Looks like same with 607 and 608, which are duties of the Dental Hygiene Committee and dental hygiene consultants.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't look like there's anything in there for this committee to address, so we will remove those. Brings us down to
Article 13.
Yeah. 1203, which is dentists and dental consultants, and it looks like there was a suggestion here by Dr. Snell, which is really to just remove that language of administering general anesthesia and refer back to the specific permits themselves, which I would agree with.
I agree. Permit. Hold a permit, 1301. License to hold a section 1301.
Speak up.
That's the definition of it.
Section 1301.
So this would change the language to say a licensee who holds a Section 1301 permit, a Section 1302 permit, a Section 1303 permit, or a Section 1304 permit who is required to obtain continuing education pursuant to Article 13 may apply those credit hours to the requirements of this section.
Okay.
Does anybody have any further discussion?
No.
That's great.
All right, hearing none, we move down to 1209, which actually has
Jessica, I think this is probably going to be a good breaking point for the day.
I think so, too, especially because 1209 doesn't have any suggested changes, which leads us into
the big one of it.
Yeah.
Yep, the famed Article 13.
Well, that'll be quick. Let's just go through. Cool.
Very good.
Well done.
All right.
Hey, if I may, could we look at just the one thing in 1301 that you redacted, but it's still in here? It's under it's on page 12, section C, deep sedation or general anesthesia for pediatric patients. That's something that Dr. German had redacted previously. Yep, right there.
So it should be removed.
Yeah.
You can take that whole paragraph out.
Yep.
Thanks, Randy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's almost a third of the page.
You're getting through that apple.
Okay. All right. So that'll be our stopping point. I'll make a note. And then what I typically do is update the draft before the next meeting so that you all have the same fresh copy with all of the changes that we've made. And then we'll start back up at Article 13.
All right. Jessica, thank you for all your help.
That was really helpful, Jessica.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right, then let's move along to agenda item number 4, study and review of adverse occurrence reports. I don't think we have anything on that. Moving to agenda item number 5, summary of current events. Brian, do you have anything specifically on that?
Just real quick. Dr. Blazek actually referred to it earlier, and I'll share my screen real quick here. this is the, we started writing the common pitfalls, mm-hmm. and originally we did this thinking we had more time. we have so many staff that we thought we got stuff we have to fill our time with. I'm kidding, of course, didn't realize that when we started the process in April that we weren't going to be as effective getting these out on a quarterly basis. We're going to try now. Yasmin has been super helpful. Everybody has, including, but I wanted to point out Yasmin. Her and I worked on this together. She's ultimately the one that sent this out, or actually it came from Christina on an email blast. And this was all about, I think it came from this committee. You guys wanted the next one to be all about anesthesia. That's why this common pitfalls 2, version 2 came out, was related only to anesthesia. I'm sharing my screen only so that you guys can see. These are the questions, especially for like Dr. German. I think Dr. German's the only one that's not licensed by this board, but this is what we sent out. There's an introduction. It's hard to see on this computer because it kind of crunched it down. But then we ask about 6 or 7 questions, and we'll do these periodically. But this one was all anesthesia related, so we thought we'd show it to you. So far, the response is not that great. It's not terrible, but you can see from the top, there's 716 people that have responded. I'm going to refresh it. Oh, there's that big intro. Yep, still 716. So these are the questions, and then as you answer them, depending on how you answer, you get a response. And a lot of the time, the response is identical, and we just quote the rule or whatever to basically say where we got this question or whatever. So it's been helpful. This is I coach soccer, and I coach 2 girls that both of their dads, one of their dads is an endodontist, and I'm not sure what the other one is. I think it might just be a general dentist, not just. he's a general dentist. And they talked to me about it. They thought it was pretty cool that we're doing this. So Yasmin is going to, we'll try to do another one at the beginning of the year, and then we will try to do them quarterly. We'll probably throw in anesthesia questions periodically, but so if you come across something that you want, feel free to let us know. So mm-hmm. One of the questions on here that's getting the most
wrong answers
is number 7. It is required for a dental practice to have at least 1 automated external defibrillator in their practice, or in the practice, true or false?
False.
But we changed it.
But it's good. So this did come out of this committee to the recommendation to the board. There will be hopefully legislation run in the 22 legislative session to make this a requirement. So this is an answer that's being answered incorrectly almost, I think it's over 75% of the time. Which is actually good, because then it appears as though this is something that we should already have had and dentists want. So, and that was it for current events.
Thank you for your work with that, Ryan, and Yasmin, staff.
For sure, right.
Agenda item number 6, discussion of possible action items for future meeting agendas.
So I'm not really so sure how we would go about this, but you know, in the previous meeting we talked about some things that just came up at the House of Delegates for the American Association of Maxillofacial Surgery that did pass, and it goes back to my comment earlier. It's all about a culture of safety, and I would like us to have a discussion about whether or not we start to include requirements for SIMMAN. You know, every 5 years or every 3 years, if you're going to renew your permit, we have requirements for some type of an anesthesia assistant. And those are 2 of the items I think that might pertain to our discussion of statutes, or with all due respect, you know, to the board, is that something that comes outside of this purvey? You know, I don't want to bear us down with more stuff for sure. I'm like, we're all about ready to be moving on. But I do think it's important, you know, so oral surgery, we have a definition of an anesthesia assistant, and courses they have to take in order to be like we have in the feed thing about, you know, ACLS or PAL certified, that kind of stuff.
So And I noticed Mary's gone. This is probably more of a legal question, so I'll try to address it without her here. It's something that definitely can go on this agenda, but I think it does outlast the purview of what this committee was established for, which was to change the rules related to anesthesia. That said, there could be some sort of nexus that would be a reason to have it at least on an agenda to talk. Do we want to add something like this to the current dental rules related to anesthesia in a dental practice? So I don't know that it's totally outside the purview, but just in a cursory.
So what I'd like to do, if it's okay, is to put something together and circulate before the next meeting that we'd have, you know, that we could all read and get an idea like where I'm coming at with that.
Is your intention to try to get some rules changed or added based on that? And I ask that more out of concern for what Ryan brought up, where I think we're starting to reach a time limit on the committee making a recommendation to the board. And, you know, we saw last year what happened when we weren't moving quick enough.
Gotcha.
I think it's a great idea, but I think if the intention is to try to get that implemented into this, it may derail some of the progress we've made.
Okay. So what I'd like to do is just circulate it, and we can put it at the very end.
Okay.
And if we doesn't have time to get to it, then we'll bring it up later.
Great.
That's good with me.
I think that's great. So we'll keep moving through.
Correct. Don't want to distract from what we're doing right now.
I think it's very appropriate then.
Okay.
Just send, and if you'll just send it to either Yasmin or myself, and then we'll get it. We'll try to get it formalized onto an agenda.
Cool.
Yep.
Okay. Anybody else for possible future meeting items? Then moving on to agenda item number 7, next committee date is November 19th. That's probably a Friday then, Ryan?
Yeah, it should be.
And then agenda item number 8, adjournment. Can I get a motion to adjourn?
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
And I will second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. None opposed. All right. Thank you, everybody.